This is number 0065, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0065. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, meet author Ken Harmon. He has written the book, The Fat Man, A Tale of North Pole Noir. Writing about murder at the North Pole, what was it in little Ken's life that perhaps led him to write this kind of dark holiday tale?
I think I noticed from a very early age that Christmas, with its message of joy and peace on earth, was also, there's a dichotomy with, there's always violence. I mean, even in at the first Christmas, Herod is trying to murder someone. So I always picked that up. I must admit that when I was cast as a shepherd boy in a church production of the Christmas story, we had a heckler, and I went after him with my shepherd's staff. So just the knowledge of violence always being around the holidays has always stuck with me, and I've always thought it kind of funny.
Ramon Stoppelenburg has created the European Cooking Trip, a chance for you to see great countries and cook great meals.
It's a 21-day journey through 7 European countries with 1 cooking course in every country. So imagine you always wanted to go to Europe, but you have to save the money, you don't know where to go, you want to see a few countries and a few locations. Then I have created this package that takes you basically through France, Spain, Italy, Croatia, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Germany in 21 days, and is offering a cooking course of the national dishes of these countries in one package.
Tina Oh is the designer behind WannaWear. She makes clothes that are not only affordable for women, but they emphasize the beautiful natural curves that they have.
Most of my dresses are actually formulated around the traditional wiggle dress that was popular in the 40s and 50s. But believe it or not, it actually started in the 18th century with the corset.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0065, was Eric Cohen, a journalist producer that you can see on Global News, plus at Cineplex, and he does some work at Simpatico as well. Plus, he's also a musician, a very, very busy guy, and we thank you very much, Eric, for being the guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We start off with a story from Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. A central Kentucky man says he was forced to eat his beard after an argument about a lawnmower that got out of control. Harvey Westmoreland of Lawrenceburg says that 2 men cut off his beard, stuffed it in his mouth, and forced him to eat it. Westmoreland said 2 former friends, I guess they'd have to be former friends now, got angry as they tried to negotiate a price for a lawnmower they wanted to buy from Westmoreland. He said, "One thing led to another, and before I knew it, there were knives and guns, and everything just went haywire." The 2 men pleaded guilty to charges related to the incident, and will be sentenced next week. And I'm guessing they're not getting the lawnmower either. Not that they'll need it if they're going to jail. Meanwhile, on to New Haven, Connecticut. Police say a 25-year-old Connecticut man who was shot twice after buying a sandwich at a New Haven deli went home and ate his sandwich before going to the hospital. Miguel Soto said he was leaving the deli when he heard 3 gunshots. 1 bullet hit him in the left leg, another in the groin. How do you not know a bullet hit you in the groin, by the way? Anyway, police said he went home and ate the sandwich before asking his father to take him to the hospital. Police do not say whether Soto realized immediately that he had been shot or if he decided that the injuries were not serious enough to require an immediate hospital trip. Again, a shot to the groin. I'd be running screaming to the hospital, but that's just me. Officers say his injuries were not life-threatening and no arrests have been made so far. And you know, that must be one hell of a sandwich. That's all I've got to say. One hell of a sandwich. Neil Thompson of St. Louis, Missouri has an interesting hobby. He likes to dress up like Jesus and then visit a new church every week to spread his Christian message. But he quickly found out that not every church is interested in a visit from Jesus. When he got to St. Paul's Church, police were called and he was asked to leave. When he tried to enter the church, Thompson said he was not allowed in the sanctuary. Instead, church members told him that he would have to sit in the hallway. After Thompson protested, a deacon called police. Interestingly, they didn't charge Jesus with any crime, but did ask him to leave the premises, which he did. Jesus saves, just not there. In Boston, Jillian Sherlock and Nicole Pereira were married at the Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta Church, and neither had any idea that the limo containing their five bridesmaids had just been carjacked on the way to the wedding. A man smashed a passenger side window of the limo with a hammer as it approached the church. All five bridesmaids fled the car in flowing blue gowns and with their fuchsia bouquets still intact, and then they pulled off the ultimate task. They made it all the way through the wedding without the bride ever knowing a thing about it. As one of them said, they didn't want to create a bad vibe on Jillian's special day. In fact, hardly anyone at the wedding knew what happened until after the ceremony. As people exited the church, they found five police cars outside and one corner of the church sealed off with crime tape. Now, those are nice bridesmaids. What do you think? Really nice bridesmaids. Moving right along, two constables in western Pennsylvania decided driving around in a car resembling a police cruiser was preventing them from serving warrants, so they decided to go black and gold. Constable U.B. Coleman and Albert Yonkin used a van decorated in Pittsburgh Steelers colors and the team logo. Coleman says they drove up to houses and honked the horn. People came out to see them because they were curious about the van. That's when they served the court papers. They also played the team's fight song when transporting people to a district judge. The constables borrowed the van from a car dealership. They say they won't use it again since their cover has been blown, but they are looking for other unique ways to get their job done. You know, I'm thinking that perhaps the Pittsburgh Steelers are not too amused by that story, but that's just a guess on my part. Anyway, getting to our last story in this section of the Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest. You wouldn't think that the world would be able to create a controversial piggy bank, but it has, and now the Winnipeg Humane Society in Manitoba is outraged. They're protesting and calling for the ban of a new piggy bank that's on sale. It's a piggy bank that's made out of a real piglet, stuffed and mounted. The real piggy bank is for sale on a website called thecheeky.com, which describes itself as providing ideas to make the World Wide Web smile and from time to time frown like a baby eating a lemon. Doubt they'll sell too many of them, as the price tag is a whopping $4,000. Anyway, Aileen White, a spokeswoman for the Winnipeg Humane Society, said, "It's such an incredible in-your-face trivialization of what was once a living being. It just demonstrates such callousness and insensitivity." It is kind of cute, though. You can check out the link. I put it up on the website. Thecheeky.com is where you'll find it. It's a piggy bank, a real piggy bank. And you know, if you have the $4,000, maybe you might want to give it as a present just in time for the holidays. And oh, there's a segue to our first guest. You know, as we get closer to the holiday season, thoughts tend to lean toward the happy seasonal thoughts, like Santa. But what if there was a story to be told about the North Pole that was a little darker? Joining us right now is Ken Harmon, author of The Fat Man, A Tale of North Pole Noir. Hi, Ken. How are you?
I am good. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so you've written this story, The Fat Man, with a, which I guess deals with a murder and an elf as a suspect. Is that correct?
Yes. Gumdrop Cole, he is one of Santa's elves from nearly the beginning, and he is in charge of putting coal in children's stockings. He's in charge of the naughty list, and he is framed for a murder, and he realizes that someone's playing reindeer games for keeps. And so he has to unravel the mystery to find out not only who's framed him, but as he gets deeper and deeper into the mess, he realizes that they are also after Santa, the fat man.
Hmm. Okay, so I have to go back into time here now. What happened to poor little Ken that this story has come out?
I think I noticed from a very early age that Christmas, with its message of joy and peace on earth, was also, there's a dichotomy with, there's always violence. I mean, even in at the first Christmas. Herod is trying to murder someone. So I always pick that up. I must admit that when I was cast as a shepherd boy in a church production of the Christmas story, we had a heckler, and I went after him with my shepherd's staff. So just the knowledge of violence always being around the holidays has always stuck with me, and I've always thought it kind of funny.
I just realized that you and I and probably Linus had the same role as children.
Yeah.
So was this a because when you come up with a book, you go to a publisher and you make your pitch. Was this a hard pitch to do?
Actually, no. This was the easiest thing that happened. I had written another book and couldn't sell it. Had been trying for about a year, and while I was trying to sell that one, I wrote The Fat Man, and I knew it took about a year for a book to get into publication, and it was right around the 1st of December last year, and I said, well, I'm just going to send out a query this morning. And I picked three or four agents that I had researched, sent out a query, and one of them answered within 3 hours and asked to see the manuscript, and 3 weeks later, he sold it.
Now, again, the subtitle, A Tale of North Pole Noir. So is this story written in the style of, say, the old detective novels that people were familiar with in the 30s and 40s and like?
Certainly. I've always been a fan of Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and those guys. So I really tried to pay honor to those. And just that tough guy, hard-boiled detective talk, when you mix it in with language about elves and the North Pole and toys and everything, there's a real, I think, funny element to it. And it allowed me to do a lot of playing with the story.
It's a book, obviously, that's filled with humor, and I want to know, do you laugh when you write?
Yes, I do. I do laugh out loud, and sometimes I don't know where things come from, but I enjoy myself immensely when I write.
Who do you see as your primary audience for this book? Is it someone who also enjoys a Pulp Fiction kind of noir book, or are you looking for a newer, younger audience that might not be familiar with the genre, or even kids for that matter?
It's certainly not a kid's book, because elves are involved with murders, and it's quite grisly at times, and I think that could be disturbing to kids. I think people who have a good appreciation for the old hard-boiled detective novels will like it, and it's also filled with pop references of holiday characters and songs and everything that we've accumulated in our culture for, you know, the past 50 years or so. And so to see those characters and those traditions shined under a different light, a darker light, if you will, I think people who enjoy that kind of looking at things differently will enjoy it too.
Now, as the saying goes, you have a day job. You also are an award-winning copywriter of headlines. You do brochures and commercials. So even though you are a writer, this is quite, it's like the distance running of writing to be an author, as opposed to the sprinter that you are.
Right. I wanted to, you know, the big challenge was to write something that couldn't be read in 30 seconds. And so, and like I said, it took a while. That first novel I attempted, that took over a year to just complete, because you never really know what you're doing until you started. And then I wrote that one, and I kind of had an idea then of how to pace things and whatnot. And so I wrote this one, and I really enjoyed writing the longer form stuff.
Do you find a particular interest in skewering the pop culture characters that we are familiar with, like the story of Santa and the elves? Is there a particular enjoyment in doing that and just bending that story on its ear?
Yes, I think bending any of those stories on their ear is what I enjoy, because you have a different sense of humor, a different take, and I tend to ask what if a lot. You know, what if one of Santa's elves got involved with a murder. What, you know, that's where I start with a lot of ideas, and you fiddle with them to see if they can play out and sustain a whole story as opposed to just one gag.
Now, there are some people out there, dare I say, devoid of humor, and who hate their sacred cows to be touched in any way, shape, or form. Have you had any backlash from people who say, what are you doing to Santa and his elves?
Not so far. I mean, I knew when I first thought of the idea, I first thought of it with Santa getting involved in some grisly business, and I knew I probably wouldn't get away with that. People would turn away from that, and that's not really the nature of Santa, but he does have helpers, and these helpers have just as many magical powers, and so I thought if I move the action and everything to one of Santa's helpers, I might have an easier time, because Santa's nature stays true, and all the other holiday characters, I don't really change them. I just show them when they're not always on. You know, Gumdrop tells you, you know, some days your favorite holiday characters pull on their cranky pants, and you know, they just have bad days, and if you can't stomach it, it's not your cup of cocoa. That's, you know, Gumdrop gives you a pretty fierce disclaimer before you start reading.
In your dream of dreams, when you were writing this book, thinking about its potential success, there are a few things out there that are perennials, that are big hits every year. Do you ever anticipate that maybe your book, The Fat Man, A Tale of North Pole Noir, could perhaps be turned into a television movie or an animated feature that could become a perennial hit?
Oh, sure, sure. I friends of mine who did read it when I was working on it, they said, I almost see this more as a movie than a novel. And, you know, I have to admit, the voice I kept on hearing in my head as I wrote Gumdrop, and it's written in first person, I always heard not Humphrey Bogart necessarily as doing Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe, but William Holden in Sunset Boulevard, that voice, that kind of rat-a-tat underscore voice where he was clipping the language through. I think that's some great language in Sunset Boulevard, and that's who I always heard in my head.
It's all fun and games until he ends up in the pool.
That's right. With that monkey looking at him.
The book is called The Fat Man, A Tale of North Pole Noir. It's written by Ken Harmon. And Ken, I thank you very, very much for being on the program.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this a great deal, and I hope everyone enjoys the book.
Ken Harmon, author of The Fat Man, A Tale of North Pole Noir. You can go to my website at thestuffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0065, and you'll find links to Ken's website, plus links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll let you know how you can cook and eat your way through Europe. Plus, we'll meet the creator of WannaWare. And, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff in the Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And in my ongoing quest to prove that cats are indeed evil, little pieces of evil plotting against mankind, here is the latest story. Now be sure to remind your cat, toaster ovens don't make good beds. In Port Townsend, Washington, firefighters believe a cat who liked to sleep on top of a toaster oven is responsible for starting a kitchen fire by depressing the toaster lever. Homeowner Lois Lund said she doesn't hold a grudge against her cat, Osiris. Lund says he had been sleeping on top of the oven to avoid a pet dog and probably stepped on the lever. Sure, blame the dog. Fortunately, the fire was small enough that Lund was able to put it out herself with a garden hose, thus robbing the firefighters of all their fun. Now, I would want to call the authorities in on this one because, first of all, no one's blaming the cat. And we don't know if this wasn't premeditated. Like I say, cats are plotting against mankind. I keep sharing story after story after story, but people don't want to believe me until, of course, it's too late. And then you'll remember that I said, right now, I told you so. Moving right along, there are those criminals who are so horribly bad at their craft, it almost seems as if they're secretly dying to get caught. In Homestead, Pennsylvania, police arrested a man charged with robbing someone outside a Subway restaurant. He was easy to find, as just before the robbery, he had filled out a complete job application inside the store and left his name, address, and phone number. It was just as easy for police to find the 18-year-old teenager who broke into a Florida Keys home. Apparently, he just couldn't resist logging on to his MySpace page on a computer in the home and left his page up for all to see after he left. Now, these two clowns in two different parts of the country could have easily been the idiots of the day on this program, but they're not. That's coming up later. Wait for it. Moving right along, in Gurnee, Illinois, 56-year-old Carolee Bilston has been charged with aggravated assault for allegedly attacking a police officer with what Gurnee Police Commander J. Patrick called, quote, a rigid feminine pleasure device, unquote. Police got involved after Carolee allegedly ran out of Joe's Crab Shack. Oh, Lord, that's just too easy. I'll leave it alone. Without paying her bill, something she allegedly had done before. The assault apparently occurred when a police officer went to Carolee's residence to investigate, and she just happened to have the sex toy at the ready. Got the visual in your head? Yeah. Okay, let's just move along. Talk about a man with a conscience. In Kettering, Ohio, police were called to a residence after neighbors heard strange noises and screaming coming from inside the house. When they arrived, they found a 19-year-old man in front of the house, bleeding from the nose and acting strangely. When questioned by officers, our man said he was very upset at himself for cheating on his girlfriend, so as punishment, he began hitting himself in the face with closed fists while walking around screaming. He also told police he was drunk, so he was arrested for disorderly conduct and public intoxication and taken to a hospital for evaluation. No word on whether he or still has a girlfriend or not. I'm guessing on not. And even in this day of smoke-free buildings and politically correct behavior, it's still not unusual for a proud new father to light up a cigar to celebrate the arrival of a new son or daughter. But lighting up a joint is a whole other matter. I had a new baby, and then I got high. Yeah, anyway. Police in Uniontown, Pennsylvania arrested a new father they found smoking pot in the designated smoking area at Uniontown Hospital. A nurse smelled the marijuana when she took a cigarette break in the same hospital, and a hospital security guard called police at around 3:20 a.m. The suspect later told the arresting officer, I'm having a baby and I wanted to get a buzz. He then pulled a bag of marijuana from his shoe. Okay, now to me, the truly amazing part of the story isn't the dad smoking a joint, although that's amazing on its own right. It's that he was caught by a hospital nurse having a cigarette break. I mean, seriously, lady, you're a nurse, for crying out loud. Shouldn't you, of all others, know what smoking can do to you? Really? Come on. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest, well, we've discovered another surefire way to avoid jury duty. Just tell the lawyers you were a childhood friend of Jeffrey Dahmer. In Cleveland, John Backdurf was among prospective jurors being screened last week. Now, when asked if he'd known anyone convicted of a crime, Backdurf replied, "I had a close friend in high school who killed 17 people." The answer caused the judge to freeze and lawyers to drop their pens. Couldn't you just picture that? Yeah. Anyway, John then explained how he is a graphic novelist and that he's about to publish a graphic novel called My Friend Dahmer. Needless to say, he was immediately dismissed from the jury list. So if you're trying to get out of jury duty, you might want to try that one. One thing you never want to hear from Jeffrey Dahmer was, "What's for dinner?" Yeah. And on that note, and on that segue, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. Ramon Stoppelenburg, as his Facebook page states, is a serial entrepreneur living in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, only doing fun stuff. Now, I first came into contact with Ramon during his LetMeStayForADay.com campaign of several years ago when he traveled the world and depended on, as Scarlett O'Hara said, the kindness of strangers. Now he's started a new venture, which is Ramon Stoppelenburg's European cooking trip. And Ramon joins us through Skype-to-Skype communication from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. Hi, Ramon.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. So now you're in Cambodia. You're originally from the Netherlands. So how did you end up where you are now?
Well, in the Netherlands, you already said it a little bit like that. I already escaped the rat race of not wanting to work at an office cubicle or have a boss telling me what to do. And I decided to escape even further and go to a country where the weather is always great and the people are friendly and life could be way more fun than in a Western country where you need a winter jacket at the moment.
Now, as I said in the introduction, you are a serial entrepreneur. You've got a couple of things going. One, as I mentioned, the European cooking trip, which I'll get to in a second. And also another one, which is the Expedition Kilimanjaro, and I'll get to that later. Let's start with the European cooking trip. What exactly is happening? I understand this is a 21-day adventure through 7 European countries?
Yes, it's a 21-day journey through 7 European countries with one cooking course in every country. So imagine you always wanted to go to Europe, but you have to save the money, you don't know where to go, you want to see a few countries and a few locations. Then I have created this package that takes you basically through France, Spain, Italy, Croatia, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Germany in 21 days. And is offering a cooking course of the national dishes of these countries in one package.
Now, how did you come up with this idea?
Basically, I was running Expedition Kilimanjaro already, and I had an intern working for me, and she was like, "Well, let's start something new after this. I mean, what else can we do?" She do marketing communication essay for school, and I was like, "Right, well, I don't know many other mountains that you can start an expedition on." So we started brainstorming and having dinner and enjoying our time together. And basically during dinner, I was like, food. There's nothing about food yet. I mean, there are many cooking trips and cooking courses, but there's nothing that covers Europe and all these various countries with their difference of cultures and languages. And focuses on the cooking of these countries.
Now, you go through 7 European countries. Obviously, there are more than 7 European countries. So how did you choose the 7 that you did choose?
First of all, we have to look at the popularity. I mean, if I target North American clients, what do they want to see? They might not want to go to Belgium or stay in the tip of Sweden, while they prefer Spain and Italy. So I had to like look at what the demands is, and then again, I had to look at what is popular in each country as the national dish. Do people really want to learn something with in the kitchen when they are in Italy? Well, I guess yes. They all want to know how to make pasta and learn the secrets, what you can do with olive oil in Spain.
So when you do these tours, is it a group situation? Are you taking a group of people to these locations? Or are people buying these package individually as couples and friends and so on and so forth?
No, these trips, they're all scheduled for summer next year, so it takes 21 days. There's one trip in May, in June, July, and August, and every trip is with a minimum of 4 participants and a maximum of 8. So you can either join in with your friends or just join in on board. With 4 participants, the trip actually starts off, and with 8, it's actually full, and you have to go for the next scheduled trip. But it's fully accommodated, fully guided, so I will also be the driver and the guide. The transport goes by minibus, and the cooking courses are given by really unforgettable locals.
For the purposes of the audience here in North America, is there a starting off point? Do we have to get to a particular destination in Europe where this European cooking trip starts?
Yes. Yes, because it goes to France, Spain, Italy, Croatia, Hungary, Czech Republic, and Germany. You actually have to start in Paris. Now, I don't think that many people will see it as a problem to actually be in Paris for the start of the European cooking trip. And people are actually free to come earlier and stay a few days in the big city before they actually board this trip. And it ends in Berlin, in Germany. So where people are also free to extend their stay and maybe go to other places in Europe on their own expense, on their own trip, say, hey, let's go to Amsterdam and to London.
Now, I would assume that you've done your homework. You've plotted all of this out. So in the 7 countries that you go through, do you yourself have a favorite dish?
Well, it's a bit overwhelming. In the end of August this year, I did myself a test drive. I had to figure out if all the distances driving a van is actually doable and bearable. But I love the experience. I met all these local chefs, meet these really enthusiastic people that said, wow, I run a restaurant during the night, but I'd love to show tourists, visitors, how I make my favorite dishes. And then you add the wines and you add the regional delicacies. And it's really hard to say, like, okay, the best thing I had was the Hungarian goulash, but the only one that is actually made there that I ever had. And it tastes so different with anything else. And I cannot compare that with the delicacies of France, of the paella in Spain, or the I don't even remember what I had in Italy. It was that like mouth, how do you call that?
Mouth watering?
Yes, mouth watering. I mean, you're standing there and these people are just standing in front of you, teaching you like, this is how you do it. This is how you make the dough. This is how you fold things together. Then it goes in the oven. Then you add a little bit of this and then some spices of that. Then you put it on a plate and you just go like, okay.
What does it cost to take one of these European cooking trips that last 21 days in 7 countries?
7 countries, 21 days, fully accommodated, like I said, will be 4,200 euros. So make that like worldwide available in United States dollars, then we're talking about 6,000 United States dollars.
That sounds pretty reasonable. You get to travel, you get to learn something, and it's definitely an experience, not your usual trip. It's certainly a little bit off the beaten path. It sounds like a great idea. People can check out the website, by the way, which is EuropeanCookingTrip.com, and we have just about a minute. So I know it doesn't do it justice, but can we talk a little bit about the expedition Kilimanjaro, which you said you did before this? What exactly does that entail?
It's still running really strong. It's a package of 11 days in Tanzania. You come to Tanzania on your own transport. You get picked up at the airport. You stay two nights at a hotel, and then you climb the Kilimanjaro, the mountain, the highest mountain in Africa, in 7 days. You camp for six nights on the mountain. Then you come back down again, hopefully made it all the way to the summit. And then you stay another two nights at a local hotel, and you get brought back to the airport again. And that's one big package, which is Expedition Kilimanjaro, and it's running great at the moment.
Excellent. Now, you know, as I said, I met you years ago when you came to Canada during your LetMeStayForADay.com campaign. You strike me as a person, since you just moved to Cambodia, you strike me as a person who can't stay still for too long. How long do you think you'll be in Cambodia?
I think I'm trying to figure out how life is in Asia. I mean, it's a big change. Southeast Asia, a lot of things that I have to get used to, not only the weather, because it's about 30 degrees Celsius at the moment, but it's the lifestyle. How do people do business? What is possible here? And what can I do there for to help those people with their business? So I don't know how long. I think I had enough time in Europe as a freelancing producer myself to actually check it out here and give everything a try.
Well, I know that everything with you, Ramon, is an adventure. I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you very much, too.
Ramon Stoppelenburg and his European cooking trip. You can check out his website at europeancookingtrip.com. You can also check out the other site, expeditionkilimanjaro.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0065, and you'll find all those links I just mentioned. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones. Is a child who isn't old enough for kindergarten still old enough to be sued in court over a bicycle accident? Sadly, one judge in New York says yes, and his decision makes me wonder what has happened to common sense in our courts. A four-year-old little girl who still needed training wheels on her bike accidentally ran into an elderly woman on a Manhattan sidewalk. The lady was injured, and her family decided to sue the child. Incredibly, the judge decided to allow this young child to be sued for negligence, a word she can probably barely pronounce, let alone understand. As a result, she'll undergo questioning from lawyers and be taught a lesson that many of us didn't have to learn until we were adults, that we cannot always rely on judges to do what is right. Let's be fair. Judges can interpret laws based on what is reasonable, and this judge could have dismissed this lawsuit. If judges don't know that four-year-olds should not be sued over a bicycle accident, it's up to us to tell them. Find out more. Go to my website at bobdirigojones.com.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times best-selling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the creator of WannaWare. Plus, we also have an idiot of the day, and we have more stuff for you right here, right now. I want to quickly mention, don't forget, The Stuff File store is now open. You can go to the website at thestufffile.com and check out The Stuff File store. Things like t-shirts, caps, mugs, water bottles, tote bags, a whole array of items that are just in time for the holiday season, or stuff you might want to have around your own home. So there you go. The Stuff File store at thestufffile.com. Now, back to The Stuff File. Kyla J. Brumley, age 28, of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, was about to give birth. At least that's what she said when she allegedly ripped off her pants and underwear outside a local bar. Brumley refused to answer questions when police arrived, instead yelling, "Get it out!" and rolling around on the ground when others tried to cover her uncovered bottom half. But officers saw no evidence that Brumley was in labor or even pregnant, so they handcuffed her and took her to an area hospital where tests confirmed that she was not having a baby anytime soon. On a positive note, an imaginary baby is much easier to raise, which brings us to our next story. More proof that our economy isn't what it used to be. You can now only get a measly $30,000 for your grandson in Florida. Yes, police arrested 45-year-old Patty Bigby and 42-year-old Lawrence Works in Dayton Beach after they met with an agent posing as a buyer. They were trying to sell their infant grandson. Now, Patty had originally sought $75,000, but got talked down to $30,000 by some obviously very shrewd undercover agents. The infant boy's real mother, Stephanie Bigby Fleming, age 22, is already in prison on unrelated charges, so he has been turned over, he being the child, to child welfare officials. Lest you think the grandmother was totally heartless in trying to sell her grandson, she was at least willing to share. Her daughter was going to get $9,000 of the proceeds to buy a car. Ah, family values, huh? And remember, folks, you need a license to buy a dog. But anybody can have a child. There you go. Now, you can't expect people who have set their own behinds on fire to really tell the truth, can you? In Australia, a 13-year-old boy and his 10-year-old buddy decided to pour gasoline on a small playground slide, then set it on fire and slide down it with the intent of putting the flames out with their butts. Yeah, I know. Didn't work out that way. Instead, our young, dumb friend got second-degree burns after his pants and underpants caught fire. Clearly embarrassed by his own stupidity, the boy first told police he had been mugged, but that couldn't quite explain the burn marks on his hiney, so he finally came clean. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, if you listen to the show on a regular basis, how come these two kids aren't the idiots of the day? Well, first of all, that comes later. But I just felt that at 10 and 13 years old, they have still more years to grow into their stupidity, or hopefully grow out of it. So give them time. But we do have a story in the Darwin file, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. The Colorado Springs, Colorado police arrested John Winkler, age 20, on two outstanding felony warrants. He was handcuffed behind his back and placed in the front seat of an unmarked squad car and seat-belted in. Okay, you got the picture? As two officers escorted him to the county jail, they were driving on the freeway when Winkler suddenly popped his seatbelt off, opened the door, and jumped out. The car was moving at about 60 miles per hour. Now, amazingly, when Winkler stopped sliding and rolling, he was able to get to his feet and start running, right into the path of an oncoming car traveling at a similar speed. He was killed. Instantly. And as I said, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Let's get to our next guest, shall we? Tina O of Beverly Hills is an all-American fashionista with a passion for style, glamour, and beauty. She is the mind behind WannaWear, a line that celebrates designs that emphasize class and sexy sophistication while celebrating the beautiful natural curves of a woman's figure and silhouette. And women can look this way while still within budget. Tina O is on the line with us right now. Hi, Tina. How are you?
I'm wonderful, Peter. How are you up in Montreal?
I'm fine. Thanks for being with us on the program. I was checking out the website, and one of the things I noticed is that the women look like women.
Yes, that's my favorite thing. It's kind of what inspired me after being in Catholic school and wearing parochial uniforms. So I wanted to celebrate a woman's curves. Because, and I know men like to, but I like it when women do.
Because so many models and so many things you see on models are they're, as Joy Behar would say on The View, skinny bitches.
Yeah, and you know, most women aren't, and most women are meant to have curves. So I like to make sure that they wiggle this way. Most of my dresses are actually formulated around the traditional wiggle dress that was popular in the 40s and 50s. But believe it or not, it actually started in the 18th century with the corset.
Wow. So when you started designing WannaWear, did you get a pushback from other designers, from the fashion industry saying, no, this is not what the world is ready for?
No, I think, you know, as usual, I'm a little ahead of my time, and now everybody's kind of following me. I never listen to what anybody says. So I just kind of do what inspires me, and I go forward, move ahead, try to detect it, and I'm never too late.
Now, I understand you grew up in Vegas?
Well, first through ninth grade. I was born in Minnesota, Minneapolis, actually, so I'm a northern girl. And my father was an interior designer for the mayor, Orrin Gregson, during the Rat Pack era. So I used to witness the ladies and gentlemen of that era always dressing after five. And it impressed me and left a huge impression on me.
It's interesting because you grew up in that era and it's left obviously an impression. One of the big television shows that's a hit these days is Ad Men.
Mad Men.
Mad Men, rather. And the thing about Mad Men is it is another show that celebrates women's curves.
Right, and it, all of a sudden it's really taken off. For two reasons, I believe. Number one, the fashion, because it is a classic fashion, and it was a time when fashion actually changed. That was the way ladies dressed, not children. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, back then there really wasn't a junior's division of fashion, and then back in the 60s, that's when it did kind of separate. And so my clothing line still is indicative of how a lady or a woman would dress, not a teenager. And I think especially out in L.A., that's one thing that really motivated me, is that I really find a lot of women out here, women, dress like teenagers. So it's like, you've been out, and I used to hand out a lot of fashion against the law tickets just on Rodeo Drive.
So
anyway, but it's been really great watching a lot of women wiggle into my dresses and wear them. And once they get one, they get two or three or four. I've got one gal that's already got 14 pieces.
Now, one of the things I mentioned in the introduction was the fact that you do celebrate women's shape and style, but that you can do it on a budget. That's a win-win for women.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, I kind of put a bomb in Beverly Hills right on Rodeo Drive as well, because I was really concerned about how much dresses were costing and the quality. There are dresses that look similar to mine that are about the same price point, but it is not even close to the quality. So my quality is a little bit closer to what you'd see at Neiman Marcus. But I don't have a store, so I do the online thing, so no bricks and mortar. In order to keep my dresses in line, I stay online.
So how is that working for you? And we should mention the website. Website is wannawearbytinao.com, correct?
Right, www.wannawearbytinao.com. Or you can just put in wannawear and you'll go right to it. Or just go to Tina O and you'll go right to it. But it's wannawear, and then you just go to it, and there's dresses and jackets and pants, and there's even more than just dresses, but I do specialize in the dress.
Now, how long have you been doing this?
Well, it took me 3 years to put it together. I have a partner, Cynthia Lee. She oversees the manufacturing because we are made in America, actually, outside of Washington, D.C., in Arlington, Virginia. And then my store is here. But like I said, we are internet. I've got orders coming in from Australia, Germany, and Canada, as a matter of fact. But it's been 9.5, almost 10 months that I've been open, but this has been about a 3.5-year project for me.
Now, again, another way you seem to be going against the grain from a lot of other people out there is that one of the things I've heard about in the past, and I'm sure you must have heard of this when you started your business plan, is that women don't necessarily like to buy clothing online because they can't put it on and try it on. Was that a concern when you first started this, and is that a concern that has not been a problem?
It's been a concern, but what's really nice, and just so you know, and I don't want to jinx myself, but I've not had one return yet. And the reason being is that I don't sell it by sizes. I sell it by your measurements. Sizing was a mass production for the masses so that people could just go in and get a 2, 4, 6, 8, or 10. I want your bust, your waist, and your hip measurement and your height. And the reason I don't get returns is because it's made exactly for you. Every piece is made individually, so it takes 2 to 3 weeks to get.
So how big do you think this is going to get for you? Where do you see this going in the future with Wanna Wear by Tina O?
I see it actually, I would say, I've got a five-year plan. I think eventually Wanawear will have stores. I think right now, Wanawear, you might as well like jump on it now, because Wanawear will be just like a rocket. And what will happen is that Wanawear will probably end up going into a production of, you know, where we do more of the sizing, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10s, and then the Tina O division will be more of the custom sizing. But right now, I would say business is very, very good, and it's all really due to my friends and my Facebook. So that's really helped me a lot. I would have to say that 50% of my sales have all been driven from my Facebook, and then of course now I've got news anchors in LA wearing it. I've got Sonia Morgan from Real Housewives of New York is wearing it, and I'm actually on next season, a couple episodes actually.
I always wanted to ask a fashion designer this: who do women dress for? Do they dress for men? Do they dress for themselves, or do they dress for other women?
I would say the majority of women dress for themselves. There is always a percentage that dress for men, but that's usually for an occasion. But for the most part, they dress for men. What I always like to stress is that, you know, fashion comes and goes, but your own personal style always stays in, and you're the queen of that. So, and you should dress the way you wish to dress. And most women do like to dress like women.
I'm glad you say that.
Yeah, and with a little bit of encouragement.
And
it's always nice to hear other women encourage other women to dress like a woman. And if they tell you not to, she's not really your friend.
There you go. The website is wannawearbytinao.com, and people can check out the website and find out what's there as far as fashions are concerned, and also place their orders. I thank you very, very much, Tina, for taking time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure speaking with you. And, by the way, I also have gentlemen inquiring all the time and getting gift certificates. So if gentlemen don't know what to get them, you can always get a gift certificate and send it to your girlfriend, wife, or daughter.
Tina O, creator of the Wanawear clothing line. You can check out their website at wannawearbytinao.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, and that's show number 0065. And you'll find the links to Tina's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
An inmate in Tachita Correctional Institute in Wisconsin forged documents to gain custody of another inmate's 12-year-old son and also his trust fund. But Christine Flynn, 52, made a couple of significant errors. First, she identified herself as the boy's adoptive father-to-be. Worse was how she allegedly signed the court order. Instead of the signature of Fond du Lac County Circuit Judge Stephen Wenke, the documents were signed Stephen Winky. When Flynn mailed the documents in to set her plan in motion, the recipient noticed the misspelling and turned them over to officials for investigation. Flynn pleaded guilty to 3 counts of trying to impersonate a judge and now faces up to 22 and a half years in prison, an upgrade sentence because she has been judged a habitual criminal. And with another 22 years to go, she'll be an habitual inmate as well, too. She's actually a habitual idiot, too. Why would Christine think this harebrained scheme of hers would work? One reason, and one reason only: she's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0065. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0065. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me at facebook.com/PAHolder and twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJMedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national air carrier China Airlines, and over the air at World FM in New Zealand, Gold FM in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.